The Golden Age of Radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the Golden Age of Radio, the case of Abigail Murray on an episode of I Deal in Crime. We'll also hear about the mystery of the room upstairs on Incredible But True, and a lecture by English philosopher Bertrand Russell. Stay tuned for the Golden Age of Radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, we'll hear about the mystery of the room upstairs on Incredible But True, and a lecture by English philosopher Bertrand Russell on living in the atomic age. Right now, the case of Abigail Murray on an episode of I Deal in Crime starring William Gargan, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
In crime. The American Broadcasting Company presents I, Deal in Crime, starring William Gargan as Ross Dolan.
This is Ross Dolan speaking about a woman named Abigail Murray. And if you can draw a picture from the name Abigail, your mental photography is probably correct. She's tall, skinny, with a prim mouth and a primmer figure. She and Forty became acquainted quite some time back, and she dresses in solid black. I met Abigail Murray in quite the conventional manner. How do you do?
All right, young man. If you're ready to take your feet off your desk and sit up like a gentleman, I'm ready to discuss a business matter with you.
Oh, I'm so sorry, madam. I was so interested in your entrance that I forgot my manners.
Oh, well, I can see that. Do you mind if I sit down?
No, not at all. Please do.
Thank you, Mr. Dolan. You are Mr. Dolan?
Yep.
I'm Abigail Murray. I live in Norwalk, and I'm here in the city on a visit.
I see.
Also, I happen to be a school teacher.
I thought so, Miss Murray.
Please, call me Miss Abigail. I'm used to that. Been used to it for 30 years.
Okay. Miss Abigail it is.
Now, I want to employ you, Mr. Dolan. You're to be my escort. Are you willing to be that?
Well, that depends.
Now, we're not going out to nightclubs and places of that nature. If that's what bothers you, I'm not the type.
No, I'm afraid you're not.
I merely want you to drive me across the city this evening. I'm visiting an old pupil of mine, and I dislike driving in the dark.
That's all, huh? Just drive you around tonight?
Certainly.
Miss Abigail, there must be more than that. If you just wanted to go across town, you could have taken a taxi cab or the streetcar.
Oh, no, I couldn't do that. All on account of the letter.
Letter?
Of course, the letter. The one I have in my purse.
Oh, Miss Abigail, you didn't tell me about the letter.
Well, naturally not. I haven't come to it yet.
Well, this letter, what does it say?
It merely says that I'm going to be murdered tonight.
I took a long look at Abigail Murray, and believe me, she wasn't kidding. Also, in her prim New England manner, she wasn't particularly worried about the threatening letter either. She handed it to me, and I read it. Abigail Murray, you should have stayed in Norwalk. Now it's too late, because tonight you are going to die. How did you get this letter, Miss Abigail?
It came to the hotel where I'm residing, by special delivery.
But who could have sent this letter? Do you have any enemies?
Well, I've been a school teacher for 25 years. What do you think?
Well, I think the police station is a good spot for you. Come on.
Mr. Dolan, I wish you would dispel the notion that you can order me around like a simpleton. I've never gone to the police, and I'm not going to go now.
But, Miss Abigail...
Now, do you wish to escort me across town tonight, or shall I find someone else?
Okay, you win. I'll be your escort.
Fine. I'm staying at the Plaza. Pick me up at 7.
Oh, no. If you want me to guard you, I'm starting in right now.
But I'm going to the beauty parlor. having my hair waved.
Well, I'll be glad to come along to make sure the curl isn't too permanent. Abigail Murray picked up her bag, stuffed a threatening letter in it, and left my office with me right behind. She really did have a date with a hairdresser, and I spent an interesting 3 hours in the outer room playing handies with a manicurist. Then we had dinner. I had a steak fried while Miss Abigail stayed in New England and had hers boiled. At 8 that evening, we were driving along in her car.
You know, Mr. Dolan, this is the first time I've driven my car in the city at night.
I know, I can... Hey, look out! Hey, didn't you see that truck?
Of course I saw it, but I had the right of way.
Oh, fine.
After all, it was his duty to get out of my way.
Uh-huh.
They always get out of my way in Norwalk.
Yeah, yeah, I don't blame them. By the way, just where are we going?
To visit an old pupil of mine at 327 Kendall. His name is Richard Way. He's been seriously ill. When he heard I was going to visit the city, he invited me to come and see him.
Would he be the person who sent you that letter?
Richard? Oh, hardly. He has the general courage of a field mouse.
Hmm.
Well, we'll turn here and take a shortcut to the park. I enjoy parks at night.
I would never have believed it. Oh, Miss Abigail, slow down a little.
Why?
Slow down, that's all.
Well, but why?
There's a car in back of us.
You think there's something wrong?
Motion him to go around us. He's been trailing us the last few blocks.
Very well.
The guy had fired 3 shots at us. Abigail let go of the steering wheel, and our car made a sharp right turn into a convenient tree. By the time I untangled myself and got out, the would-be killer had disappeared in a cloud of blue smoke.
Those shots. They came right through the back window. He was shooting at us.
Not us, Miss Abigail. He was shooting at you. Now, let me see if the car is all right, and then you and I are going to the police. We should have done that in the first place.
I want to visit Richard Way.
Later. Now, let's see. He's banged up the front of the car.
Is everything all right, Mr. Dolan?
Yeah. You didn't do any damage. Just dented one fender of the... Uh-oh.
Now, what's wrong?
The tire, it's flat. Is there a spare in back?
Oh, yes, of course.
Well, hand me the keys, will you? We'll have to change that tire before we go any further.
Here they are.
Now, you just take it easy, and I'll have this beauty switched in a hurry.
Perhaps I could help, Mr. Dolan.
Okay, come along. Now, we'll just take this wrench, find the jack, and get back, Miss Abigail.
Why? What's wrong, Mr. Dolan? What's that bundle in there?
That's no bundle. That's the body of a man.
A man? Well, tell him to come out immediately.
I don't believe it would do any good. He's dead.
The
dead man was tucked into the back of the car like a sack of potatoes. We got a flashlight out of the glove compartment of Abigail Murray's car and looked him over. He'd been shot once. I could see that right away. Then Miss Abigail gave out with a startled exclamation.
Mr. Dolan, that's Richard.
Richard?
Richard Way, the man I was going to visit this evening.
We've got to get to a telephone right away, Miss Abigail. The police will have to be notified.
They'll ask a lot of questions.
Oh, murder always brings out the bump of curiosity on a policeman's head.
Of course, he could have committed suicide.
Oh, sure. This would look like suicide to anyone. The man shoots himself through the heart, then he climbs into the back of your car, pulls down the door, and locks it from the outside. Try again, Miss Abigail.
I've got it. That's how I was going to be murdered.
You mean they mistook Richard Way for you?
No. Don't you see? The person who wrote me that letter killed Richard Way. They put his body in my car. They knew it'd be found back there. I'd be accused of murder.
I don't know. That sounds like a long way around to arrange a murder frame. Well, let's lock this back and get out of here.
We're quite a ways into the park, Mr. Dolan. You think it's safe to walk?
It is, if we walk where there isn't a road. I don't think our friend would leave his car. Uh-oh.
A car. He's come back.
Out of sight, quick.
Is it the same man?
I don't know. I can't see good enough. Oh, come on, Miss Abigail. We've got nothing to worry about now.
But the man in that car, he'll see us.
I want him to see us. That car happens to be a prowl car.
All right, you two, what are you doing back there? And is this your car?
That happens to be my car, officer.
Oh, it happens to be your car, eh?
Don't you know it's against the law to park off this road?
We had a flat tire, officer.
Flat tire, eh? And you were looking for your spare back there, huh? In the bushes.
Officer, I'm Ross Dolan, the private investigator.
So what?
Somebody fired a gun at us while we were driving through here. You can see the bullet holes in the back window.
Go on.
I got out and opened the back to get at the spare tire. There's a dead man in there.
So you looked inside and found it. Did you say dead man?
Yeah.
I'll have a look in the back of your car. Come on, both of you.
But, Mr. Officer...
Come on, I said. Now unlock that turtle bag.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You didn't touch him, take anything out of his pockets.
Naturally not. Do I look like the sort of person who would touch a dead man?
You look like the sort of person who's coming down to headquarters and have a little chat.
Headquarters? Why, this is disgraceful.
Miss Abigail, if you only let me...
One might think that Mr. Dolan and I were murderers.
Yeah, one might think you were.
Carter was one of those coldly efficient cops. He had me drive his police car to headquarters while Abigail Murray fumed, fussed, sputtered, and threatened. But it was like knocking down stone fences with a handful of sponges because Carter just sat back with no further comment. When we got to HQ, he herded us into a room for questioning.
I shall certainly telegraph the mayor of Norwalk. I've never before been treated in such degrading fashion.
Now, don't take it so hard, Miss Abby. All we've got to do is prove that we didn't kill Richard Way, and they'll let us go.
But why do we have to prove it? I always thought a person, was presumed innocent until they were proved guilty. And so far, no one has proved anything.
I know.
And that officer, that Carter person.
Did I hear somebody mention my name?
You certainly did, and it was I.
I thought so. Now then, I want to ask you both some questions. After that, we'll decide what's to be done. You, Dolan, I looked over your identification.
Yeah?
What's your story?
Well, Miss Murray employed me to drive her across town. I took the job. We were driving through the park. Somebody took a shot at us and blew out a tire.
That's when we found Richard. I mean the body.
Miss Murray, I was talking to Mr. Dolan. When I finish with him, there are some matters you and I shall discuss.
I was just trying to help.
You'll get your chance.
Oh.
Now, you found the body, eh?
Yeah, when I opened the turtle back on the car to get at the spare tire.
Then what?
Then I started looking around for a cop.
In the bushes, off the road. What kind of a cop were you looking for?
All right, Carter, you're having your little fun, but you forget. Some guy with a gun had just fired 3 shots at us. Did you expect me to parade around like a big fat target?
Go on.
Well, when we heard your car approaching, we ducked. When I saw the PD label on the door, we came out, period.
Okay. Now, Miss Murray, you employed Dolan because you were afraid you'd received a threatening letter.
I substantiated that statement with proof, Mr. Carter. I gave you the letter I received.
So you did, and that's why I'm asking all these questions. You see, the dead man, Richard Way, had some notes in his own handwriting in his pocket.
Is there something unusual about that?
There is in this case, Miss Murray. Comparing the handwriting on the notes with the letter you received, we came to the conclusion that they were both the same.
What?
The man who threatened you by mail was the man you found dead in your car.
There was a lot of similar chit-chat which took place at police headquarters, but Carter finally let us go. He warned us not to leave town, which was a little ridiculous because I have an office here, and Miss Abigail told Carter she wouldn't miss the fun at this point for a carton of eggs. I took her back to the plaza and went home to my apartment, wondering what would happen next. An hour later, it turned out to be a blonde.
I'm Faye Murray. You're Ross Dolan.
And this is pretty late at night. What's on your mind, little lady?
Don't little lady me, Dolan. Where's my aunt, Abby?
Abby? Oh, you mean Miss Abigail.
Yes, I mean Miss Abigail. Where is she?
Well, the last I saw of her, she was digging a flannel nightgown out of her telescope bag down at the Plaza Hotel.
Get out of the way. I'm going to search your apartment.
You're going to what?
Move, I said.
Now, just a second. You can't come fussing in
here. Where is she?
Try my refrigerator. She's probably hiding behind an ice cube.
I'm not going to waste time on you, Dolan. I came here to find my aunt. And if you don't turn her up in 30 seconds, I'll phone the police.
I wish you would. And while you're calling, enter a complaint for me, too.
I know all about you. You're one of those ruthless private detectives. You're 1 degree removed from a crook. You take money under tables and under false pretense.
Now, what's this all about?
You mean you don't know where Aunt Abby is?
The last time I saw her, she was ready to hit the sheets for a full complement of slumber. What gave you the idea she was here?
But I called her at the hotel. She didn't answer.
How'd you get up here?
A man answered Auntie's room. He said that she'd come up here, that you'd forced her to come with you.
Me? Force Miss Abigail to do anything she didn't want to? Why, that little old gal has a mind all of her own.
But then, who was the man in the hotel room?
That's what we're going to find out.
He's at the plaza.
I just told you that.
Oh. Dolan, are you sure you took her home?
I certainly am.
I wonder what could have happened to her.
Plaza Hotel?
Miss Abigail Murray, please.
One moment.
Did she answer?
Give her a chance, will you?
Well? Well?
No answer yet.
I'm sorry, sir, but Miss Murray is not in her room. You wish to leave a message?
Yeah. Have her call Ross Dolan when she comes in.
Yes, sir.
Oh, and one more thing. Did you see Miss Murray a little earlier this evening with a man?
A man? Let me think. Oh, yes. I saw her earlier. She came in with a big, beefy character wearing a wrinkled gray suit and a brown hat. Would you know him, sir?
I would. It happens to be me.
Oh, no, sir. You mean it was I?
It was me, and don't you forget it.
She's not there, is she?
No. And the clerk doesn't seem to remember her going out.
Well, in that case, Mr. Dolan, I'm sorry I bothered you. Good night.
Boy, she certainly was in a hurry. I wonder... Hey, Miss Murray, I want to ask you if... I never did find out what hit me, but from the size of the bump on my noggin when I woke up, I figured it was at least the Santa Fe Chief or a Constellation full speed ahead. The first thing that greeted my sight when I opened my eyes was a pair of black shoes. I let my eyes travel upwards.
All right, Dolan, what did you do with her?
Do with whom?
Abigail Murray. She's disappeared.
That's what I like about you, Carter. You always bring out the news when it's a day old.
Get on your feet. I want to ask you some questions.
You've just got no mercy at all. Hey, let me shake the ache out of my gray matter.
What happened up here? Somebody slug you?
No. I just butted my head against the wall. I do it all the time.
Now then, what happened to Abigail Murray?
You know as much as I do, Carter.
You know about the car disappearing?
Her car? Well, you took care of that.
I sent the wagon out to pick up the body. They brought in the body, and the garage man sent a truck out after the car. When he got there, it was gone.
Well, you got me. This is the first I've heard about that.
I called Miss Murray at her hotel. She had gone. No one had seen her leave. Now, Dolan, just what goes on around here? What's the gag?
I told you, I don't know. I called her, too. Her niece was up here looking for her.
Her what?
Her niece, Faye Murray.
Niece, huh?
What's wrong with that?
We checked on Abigail Murray at Norwalk, and she hasn't got a father, a mother, no brothers, and no sisters. So obviously, she couldn't have a niece. So what are you trying to give me?
A little information on what happened after I took Abigail Murray to the Plaza Hotel. I came home, was here an hour, when her niece showed up.
I'm trying to tell you Abigail Murray doesn't have a niece.
So the girl just said she was her niece.
Give me a description on the way downtown. I'll get out a call on him.
On the way downtown? Where am I going now?
I'm going to the morgue. I want you to take another look at Richard Way.
It couldn't wait for morning, huh?
I want you to see that body before it disappears, too.
I began to think about a number of things regarding Abigail Murray. Also, Faye Murray, the niece who wasn't a niece. Who was she? And why was she looking for Miss Abigail? Then we pulled up in front of the morgue, got out of the car, and went in.
Did you take anything out of the dead man's pocket, Dolan?
The first thing I learned as a private detective was to leave that strictly alone. Why?
I just wondered. In here.
Say, who's the guy over there?
You'll find out in due time. Okay, take a look. This the man you found in the back of your car?
Yep.
Sure? You can make a positive identification?
Yep. I remember where the bullet struck. Also his face.
Uh-huh. Mr. Way, would you mind stepping this way, please?
Yes.
I must be seeing double. This can't be.
Well, Dolan, what do you say now?
Well, this guy must be the dead man's twin brother. I've never seen such a resemblance before.
That's right. This is John Way, Richard Way's twin brother, Ross Dolan. Now then, Mr. Way, mind telling me again, when did you see your brother last?
About 7 o'clock. He said he had an errand and left the apartment.
Did he mention his appointment with Miss Murray?
No, he didn't.
You have no idea how your brother's body got in the back of Miss Murray's car?
None whatsoever.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Way. We'll call you if we need you.
Thank you.
Say, you want any more from me, Carter?
No, just be around where I can find you.
Well, I'll be home. Say, by the way, Have you checked the bullet holes in Miss Murray's car to see if they match with the bullet in the dead man?
I'd love to, but we haven't found the car yet.
Say, when you do, Carter, I've got a little bet for you.
Yes?
I'll give you 2-1, they match. I walked out of the morgue onto the street, leaving a very puzzled Carter standing there, but no more puzzled than a private eye named Dolan. The street was dark and forbidding. The lights in that district were black with age, and the buildings were dark and gloomy. I wondered how one twin felt when the other one died, because I'd read stories about the invisible threads which bound such people together. Then I felt a hand on my arm.
Dolan, wait.
Well, Miss Faye Murray, or have you switched to another name by this time?
Dolan, I've come to ask a favor. A big one.
And I'm going to ask one of you. Just turn around and walk back into that morgue. There's a cop there named Carter who'd just love to meet
please,
you.
Please, please, Dolan, listen to me. Forget all about Miss Abigail.
You mean your aunt? Or aren't you the niece who isn't the niece?
I can't explain anything to you right now, but if you'll promise me something, I'll tell you the whole story in a few days.
Well, that's so kind of you. I get shot at, hit over the head, dragged around by the police, lose sight of my client, and you want me to wait. What for?
This is a matter of life and death, Dolan. I'm asking you to forget about everything that's happened.
So?
Because if you don't, somebody else will die, too.
Faye Murray, if she was Faye Murray, had one great trick. She could disappear like nothing I've ever seen before. By the time I opened my mouth to ask another question, she'd melted away like a bonbon on a hot rock. I went down towards the lighted corner, and 10 minutes later was in a taxi cab. I retraced the same route I'd taken earlier with Miss Abigail, and when the cab got to the spot where the shooting had occurred, I got out and looked around. But there was nothing to look at, so I got going again. I remembered Miss Abigail mentioning the address of Richard Way. It was 327 Kendall on the other side of the park. I got out a block away. I stood there until the blinking red taillight had disappeared around the corner. I wanted to be sure no one had followed me. Then I made my way inside the apartment building and got the apartment number off the mailbox. I didn't care to announce my presence, so I took it very easy going up the stairs. The apartment building was as quiet as a grave, and the word grave reminded me of the dead man lying down in the morgue. When I got to the door of the apartment I was looking for, I could hear voices. John Way and Faye Murray, but they were too low to make out. So I looked for another method of getting in on the know. The apartment was one of those two-bedroom and bath affairs with a separate door for the kitchen. I moved inside through the kitchen. The two voices grew in intensity as I moved towards the living room door.
John, you promised.
Of course I did, my dear. Of course I did. That was to get you back here.
But you told me if I got rid of Dolan, you'd take care of everything. You'd let Miss Abigail go.
Oh, and so I am, my dear. I am going to take care of everything.
You know, I could go to the police. I could tell them the whole story.
In your present condition, I hardly think so.
In that case, I'll scream. I'll yell as loud as
you. You fool, you make one sound, or I'll kill you right now.
I took a chance and moved closer. What I saw surprised me, because the girl was tied in her chair, hand and foot, while John Way held his hand over her mouth. I started inside, but he was quicker than I was.
Put up your hand. One move and I shoot.
Dolan, I told you.
You, come here.
Sure.
So, you just couldn't take Faye's advice. You had to come around here snooping, huh?
I'm beginning to figure a lot of things, Way. You killed your brother.
Well, you're very observing.
Where's Abigail Murray? What'd you do with her?
Oh. You want to know where Abigail Murray is, do you?
Yeah.
You know, I think I'll arrange for you to find out. I'll go a step further. I'll arrange for you to go with her.
Well, she's still alive then, huh? Where is she?
In the turtle back of a car. I put her there.
Say, hey, what's the matter with this guy, Faye? Is he off his crunk?
Say, if you say I'm insane, I'll kill you right here.
So, that's the way it is.
You think I'm insane, too, don't you? That's I am. All my life, it's Richard this, Richard that, Richard the other thing.
Now, you're in pretty deep, mister. Better hand me that gun.
Oh, you think you're sly, don't you? You think I'm going to just hand it over like that? I'm not.
No?
No. No, I've got it all set up. You, Fay, and Abigail are taking a little drive with me. Only I'm coming back alone.
You stole the car, huh? Before the cops came back.
Of course. That was very clever of me, don't you think?
You answered the phone in Abigail Murray's room when Fay called her, didn't you?
Of course. I dropped in to see my old teacher. We were such pals, you know. She always gave me such good marks.
You're quite a clever guy. How'd you get her out of the hotel?
Down the back way, servant's entrance. No, it's quite deserted. I arranged that, too.
Then you came over and conked me on the head, huh?
Yes, yes, after I locked up Miss Abigail in the car.
Well, you get around, Mr. Way.
You see, I followed Fay. I thought she might do something silly like employing you. But I prevailed upon her to forget it, didn't I, my dear?
You lied to me. You told me that if I got rid of Dolan, you'd let Miss Abigail go free.
Oh, no. No. What I said was that I'd see that Miss Abigail was free. And she shall be. Because one is free when one is dead.
What are you going to do?
Drive the car in the river. They'll never find it buried in the mud.
They won't find us either.
Naturally not. You'll be in the car from now on. You, Fay, and Abigail.
And what happens when you try to get me out of here? I could start a ruckus.
I have that plan, too. Turn around.
What for?
I said turn.
Okay. Now what happens?
I'm going to hit you over the head. Not too hard, but just hard enough to keep you quiet for a while. I guess.
No, no, grab it!
You fool! Think you can make me?
I think I can! I was lucky enough to catch John Way with a fast chop to the chin. Then I phoned Carter, who came out with a squad and took John Way down to the clink. At his trial, a group of doctors testified that he was violently and incurably insane. Later, I had a meeting with Miss Abigail and, of course, Fay at the Flamingo.
My, my, Mr. Dolan. When I asked you to drive with me that night, I never dreamed that we would become involved in such an adventure.
Well, neither did I.
What puzzled me is, how did John get hold of my car long enough to put Richard's body in it?
Well, he told the doctors at the trial that he saw you take it into a filling station to have it greased. He represented himself as your brother, took the car, put his brother's body in it, and returned it to your hotel.
Think of that.
Why did he hate you so much, Miss Abby? And why hate his brother?
You know, I can't understand that. Richard was gay, a good student, well-liked. John was exactly the opposite. Moody, a bad student with violent dislikes.
It probably gnawed away at his mind until he made it up to get rid of the two people he hated.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, now, let's talk about Fay here. Why the pose is Miss Abigail's niece?
Fay, you're merely an old friend. Why did you say you were my niece?
Only because I thought it might carry weight with Mr. Dolan. Only I was weighed and found wanting.
Oh, purely in a business sense. Try me on the social time sometime.
Tonight?
The sooner, the better.
And, of course, I'm coming along, too. You know, I've never been to a nightclub. I've never even done the rubber.
Now, take it easy, Miss Abby. How do you know you like it?
Oh, I shall. After all, a girl my age can get into trouble, too.
Yeah, you can say that again. Good night, folks. Don't forget to listen again next week, same time, over most of these ABC stations, when you will hear William Gargan say,
I deal in crime.
I deal in crime, starring William Gargan as Ross Dolan, is a special presentation of the American Broadcasting Company. It is written and directed by Ted Hediger. Special music is arranged and conducted by Rudy Schrager. Now, here's a special program note. International intrigue. That's what David Harding finds himself involved in on tomorrow's thrilling counter-spy case. Don't miss David Harding Counter-Spy tomorrow afternoon over the same ABC station.
You're listening to The Golden Age of Radio in the Case of Abigail Murray on an episode of I Deal in Crime starring William Gargan. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s. When the golden age of radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. In a moment, a 1953 lecture by English philosopher Bertrand Russell on the limits of human powers. But first, the mystery of the room upstairs on Incredible But True, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
At 15, Rose Pugliese was a normal, attractive American girl. If she had one idiosyncrasy, it was what she called her intuition, about which she boasted frequently, much to the amusement of her family and friends. But after the night of February 1st, 1941, they ceased to be amused. About 11 o'clock that night, Rose's parents, returning from a neighborhood movie, found their daughter sitting in the living room, staring moodily out of the window.
Why, Rose, darling, you're still up.
I don't feel like going to bed.
Worried about something, Emmy?
No. No, not exactly.
Then up you go.
Reluctantly, Rose climbed the stairs to her bedroom. 10 minutes later, her mother glanced up to find the girl standing by her chair.
Why, Rose, what's the matter?
I can't do it, Mother. I just can't go to bed in that room.
But why not?
It's just a feeling. I feel as if I were never going to sleep in that bed again.
Well, what do you want, dear?
Stay down here in the living room, in the big chair there. I'd rather stay awake all night than go into my room again.
And neither logic nor ridicule could persuade Rose Pugliese to change her mind. An hour later, her parents retired to their own rooms. And Rose, looking disconsolate and a little sheepish, curled up in the big chair. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Pugliese opened his eyes and stared into the darkness. Something had disturbed his sleep. A sound. An odor, strange and yet unpleasantly familiar. In an instant, he was sitting erect in his bed, tugging violently at his wife's arm.
Mother! Mother, wake up!
What's the matter, dear?
We've got to get out of here! There's a fire!
Throwing their robes around them, they yanked open the door and hurried out into the hall.
Father, look! Under that door! Smoke! All the fire's in Rose's bedroom!
Before the night was over, the interior of the Pugliese home had been gutted, Rose's bedroom completely destroyed, and her bed, the bed which she had a feeling she would never sleep in again, was reduced to ashes. It was inevitable that the local newspaper should get wind of this strange affair. And when the reporter came to interview Rose Pugliese, he asked her, first of all, whether she did not think it was remarkable that her life should have been saved by a mysterious premonition.
Remarkable? No, I don't see anything very remarkable about it. You see, I've had hunches like that lots of times, and every one of them turned out to be true.
No, the story of Rose Pugliese is not a unique one. Thousands of other ordinary people have had similar hunches, similar premonitions. And as long as science rejects the idea of supernormal perception and scoffs at the gift of prophecy and yet provides us with no alternate explanation, just so long, we must continue to label such stories incredible but true.
How does a radio network go about covering a national political convention? It could be simple. Just place a microphone on the rostrum and listen to the speeches. Well, that's one way. But it wouldn't bring you the real excitement and atmosphere of a convention. It wouldn't bring you anything of the behind-the-scenes plans and deals that are so much a part of the political game. These are the reasons why NBC sent more than 300 expert newsmen and technicians to Chicago to cover the Democratic Convention beginning Monday, July 21st. There's an NBC man for every four delegates. With NBC, you'll interview the delegates, hear the candidates in formal speeches and off-guard moments, and the myriad political technicalities will be made crystal clear by America's greatest newsmen. Yes, for complete, careful, concise coverage of the Democratic National Convention, make your headquarters the NBC Radio Network. You will find that their years of leadership in radio news reporting means continued leadership in the coverage of the Democratic Convention.
Listen to another in the series of discussions by English philosopher Bertrand Russell on living in an atomic age. First, an important note. In response to popular demand, The Great Fraud returns to ABC tonight. It's a timely series of reports by Mrs. Ada Siegel, authority on the USSR and its people, which exposes the way the Soviet government constantly defrauds its citizens. Mrs. Siegel reveals false items printed in the Soviet press. She reports USSR developments in domestic and international policies since the death of Premier Stalin, and includes a forecast of future trends under the Malenkov regime. For a clearer understanding of Russia and its political policies, don't miss The Great Fraud a little later this evening on ABC. In cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation, the Public Affairs Department of the American Broadcasting Company presents transcribed the fourth in a series of six lectures entitled Living in an Atomic Age by the distinguished English philosopher, mathematician, sociologist, and author Bertrand Russell. The subject of the fourth lecture is The Limits of Human Power. Lord Russell.
The humility of the ancient shepherds, who felt themselves subject to the influences of Pleiades, is no longer appropriate in the scientific world. But there is a danger lest it should be replaced by a species of arrogance towards nature, which can lead to great disasters. Man, however scientific he may be, is not omnipotent. He is hedged in by natural limits. By means of his knowledge and technique, he can diminish the narrowness of these limits, but he can never remove them wholly. Some astronomers try to cheer us up in moments of depression by assuring us that one fine day the sun will explode, and in the twinkling of an eye we shall all be turned into gas. I do not know whether this is going to happen, nor when it will happen if it does happen. But I think it is safe to say that if it does, it will be a matter outside human control, and that even the best astronomers will be unable to prevent it. This is an extreme example, and one which it is useless to think about, because there is no way in which human behavior can be adapted to it. It does, however, serve one purpose, which is to remind us that we are not gods. There are two very different elements in science: scientific knowledge and scientific technique. Those whom I am calling technocrats are interested solely in scientific technique, and the more extreme among them deny that there is such a thing as scientific knowledge, or indeed any kind of knowledge. There are many who think that the point of view of the technocrat suffices, or if at moments they feel it somewhat arid, they supplement it not by any doubt that can be entertained by a scientific inquirer, but by an unscientific form of arrogance, namely the belief that without the patience and without the submission involved in observing nature, we can arrive by a form of self-assertion at kinds of knowledge which science is incapable of supplying. This is megalomania. Man is neither impotent nor omnipotent. He has powers, and his powers are surprisingly great, but they are not so great as he might wish. But let us have done with these generalities. It is not the generalities, but their practical application with which I am concerned. How long will it be before the accessible oil in the world is exhausted? Will all the arable land be turned into dust bowls, as it has been in large parts of the United States? Will the population increase to the point where men again, like their remote ancestors, have no leisure to think of anything but the food supply? Such questions are not to be decided by general philosophical reflections. communists think that there will be plenty of oil if there are no capitalists. Some religious people think that there will be plenty of food if we trust in Providence. Such ideas are superficial, even when they are called scientific. Modern industry depends upon raw materials which are found at or near the Earth's surface. These raw materials are the product of past geological ages. For the most part, they are not being reproduced by any natural process. The elements were built up long ago by a process which we are just beginning to understand. At temperatures much lower than that at which they were formed, they entered into chemical combinations. At a certain stage, the Earth was at a temperature peculiarly suitable to the formation of complex chemical combinations, and at last, combinations were formed which had the properties that are characteristic of living matter. Living matter has a curious property which I have called chemical imperialism. In virtue of this property, when it is put into a suitable environment, it transforms a mass of dead matter into a mass of living matter. It is this property which has made organic evolution possible. There are in nature processes of synthesis. They proceed from the simpler to the more complex. The processes of modern industry do exactly the reverse. They use complex raw material and simplify it. So far, this process of simplification is in the main not reversible by scientific methods. It may be that it will become so. Many ages ago, the energy supplied by the sun's heat was transformed into luxuriant vegetation. The energy lay locked up in the layers of petrified tropical ferns until ruthless industrialists seized it and transformed it back again into heat. But the heat that we generate when we burn coal is not localized like the heat in the sun and is not continually regenerated by atomic processes. It floats off into the atmosphere and becomes forever useless. There is no process in nature, and there is none imaginable to human ingenuity, by which heat, once diffused, can be reconcentrated, or by which, when diffused, it can serve any human purpose. All sources of energy upon which industry depends are wasted when they are employed, and industry is expending them at a continually increasing rate. Already, coal has been largely replaced by oil, and oil is being used up so fast that East and West alike conceive it necessary to their own prosperity to destroy the industry of the other. All the long geological and astronomical ages during which the materials which we find useful have been built up, contribute a moment's blaze, a moment's frivolous exuberance. But when his fireworks are finished, what will become of industrial man? All this, of course, does not appear in practice in the tragic and catastrophic form in which I have been stating it. What we know is that the price of coal goes up, and we do not readily connect this fact with the second law of thermodynamics. If you look up this law in a textbook, you will learn that it states that entropy always increases. And if you are not a physicist, you will not be much the wiser. But the law can be stated more simply, and is stated more simply by proverbial wisdom. It states, in fact, that you cannot unscramble eggs. It deals with all the irreversible processes of nature. Some processes are reversible, some are not. If you travel from London to Edinburgh, you can also travel from Edinburgh to London. But if coal is used to make your train go, there is no way by which you can collect the heat which it generates and turn it back into coal. All industry depends upon such irreversible processes. It all uses up the Earth's capital. Modern industry is, in fact, a spendthrift, and sooner or later must suffer the penalty of spendthrift. I know that most people meet such considerations with a kind of facile optimism. They say, oh, the men of science are sure to think of some clever invention, and even if they don't, it will last my time. They feel like the proverbial Irishman who said, Why should I do anything for posterity? It never did anything for me. But I am concerned in these talks with men, considered as a single creature with a single biography. I cannot be content with a brief moment of riotous living, followed by destitution. And however clever the scientists may be, there are some things that they cannot be expected to achieve. When they have used up all the easily available sources of energy that nature has scattered carelessly over the surface of our planet, they will have to resort to more laborious processes, and these will involve a gradual lowering of the standard of living. Modern industrialists are like men who have come for the first time upon fertile virgin land and can live for a little while in great comfort with only a modicum of labor. It would be irrational to hope that the present heyday of industrialism will not develop far beyond its present level. But sooner or later, owing to the exhaustion of raw material, its capacity to supply human needs will diminish, not suddenly, but gradually. This could, of course, be prevented if men exercised any restraint or foresight in their present frenzied exploitation. Perhaps, before it is too late, they will learn to do so. But this is a question of politics, and I do not wish, as yet, to consider the political aspects of our problem. So far, I have been considering the raw materials of industry, but the matter is far more grave as regards soil, which is the raw material of food. Ever since agriculture began, it has been carried on wastefully in most parts of the world. Where methods are completely primitive, the cultivator merely moves on after he has exhausted the soil of one piece of land. This requires, of course, a great deal of available territory, and even then only offers a permanent solution if the damage done to the soil by cultivation is temporary and not permanent. It is no wonder that men worshipped fertility divinities, or that they developed a belief in the magical efficacy of human sacrifice. But in former times, while the population of the globe was still sparse, the problem had not the tragic importance that it has in our own day. We all know that the price of food goes up, but most of us attribute this to the wickedness of the government. If we live under a progressive government, it makes us reactionary. If we live under a reactionary government, it turns us into socialists. Both these reactions are superficial and frivolous. All governments, whatever their political complexion, are at present willy-nilly in the grip of natural forces which can only be dealt with by a degree of intelligence of which mankind hitherto has shown little evidence. Man has existed for about 1,000,000 years, and scientific technique for at most 200 years. Seeing what it has already accomplished, it would be very rash to place any limits upon what it may accomplish in the future. But scientific knowledge is an intoxicating draught, and it may be one which the human race is unable to sustain. It may be that, like the men who built the Tower of Babel in the hope of reaching up to heaven, so the men who pursue the secrets of the atom will be punished for their impiety by providing by accident the means of exterminating the human species and perhaps all life on this planet. From some points of view, such a consummation might not be wholly regrettable. But these points of view can hardly be ours. Perhaps somewhere else, in some distant nebula, some unimportant star has an unimportant planet on which there are rational beings. Perhaps in another 1,000,000 years, their instruments will tell them of our fate and lead them to agree on an agenda for a conference of foreign ministers. If so, man will not have lived in vain.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the fourth in a series of 6 lectures by Bertrand Russell entitled Living in an Atomic Age. The subject of Lord Russell's lecture tonight, The Limits of Human Powers. Be sure to listen next week when the 5th lecture will be presented by Lord Russell on the subject, Conflict and Unification. This has been a transcribed feature of the Public Affairs Department of ABC in cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation. Your program came from New York. This is ABC Radio Network.
Just a springtime spell, for heaven knows, and time will tell. Though I know so well what we believe is love may just turn out to be time will tell. Do we really care, or do we share a fool's imagination? Night will hurry by, then you its fling. If you are in my arms, we'll know it's not a spell. We'll know it's real, but time will tell.
Golden Age of Radio on WMKY. Ella Fitzgerald with Time Alone Will Tell from 1940. We also heard a lecture by English philosopher Bertrand Russell, first broadcast on radio on June 2, 1953. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows. On the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at this same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.